It's Primus Trax with Josh and Frankie.
What a couple of dumb shits.
We are excited today to speak with Gabby Lala. Oh, you have heard her records, Be Careful What You Wish For, and I Know That You Know That I Know, which is probably the best record title I've ever heard, as well as appearances on Colonel Claypool's Bucket of Bernie Brains, Les Claypool's Of Wales and Woe, and in live performances with a fancy band. Holy cow, how do you keep all those straight? Gabby, welcome to Primus Trax. Great to have you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It is so cool to talk to you. We are big fans, of course. Be Careful What You Wish For. I listened to it when it was first released, and I will admit to you that I actually pirated it back then. I'm so sorry. But I did buy a copy in the last month through Captain Kirk Records. So
okay. I like that method.
Absolutely. I think I've atoned. For me, that was a time of moving. I was moving from Iowa to Oregon around that time. And, I grew up as a huge Primus head. And that was kind of a fallow period for Primus. And the Les Claypool solo stuff, I wasn't so into at the time. So I just remember wanting to listen to the weirdest music I could get my hands on. So I was listening to a lot of Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa, that sort of thing. Mr. Bungle, Secret Chiefs 3, all these bands. Some Scandinavian death metal. But then I got your album. And I was like, oh, this fits. This fits right into the what I'm looking for right now. So it was really good to listen to it then, and then to get a legit copy and listen to it again 15 years later or so. It definitely fit, and it was part of my soundtrack of moving. So thanks. I appreciate that.
Don't forget your backpack.
Oh, yes. in the move, I don't think I left anything behind, but I did lose a couple of t-shirts I really liked. I have no idea where they went, so they probably didn't make it into the backpack. I guess we can start kind of big picture, because you're a multi-instrumental person, musician, I guess I should say, and you have all these experiences, but take us back. I mean, where'd you kind of get started with music? There's a lot going on with your music. Was it a childhood thing?
Yes, I started playing music as a child when I was around 5 years old. I was really into that movie Annie, the original Annie with the red-haired girl. I used to sing all the Annie songs really loud in my house. Yes. And I guess a neighbor across the street heard me singing and came over and was like, "Who's singing over there?" And my mom said, "Oh, I'm sorry. It's my daughter. I can ask her to, you know, tone it down." And they're like, "No, no, no. She's going to be a singer one day, but she should come learn piano from me first." And so I started going across the street and taking piano lessons. And that woman was Mrs. Ho, and she was my first music teacher. And I just remember going to her house, and there were like a few different pianos in there. And it was just funny to like be in someone else's house and see across the street and see your house. I don't know if you ever go over to your neighbor's house and see it from another perspective, but I just remembered that. But I used to take lessons with her, and then and I played this toy piano that I have it right over here. That was my first instrument. And then I graduated to having a full-size piano.
Okay. And the toy piano that is nearby you is the same one that you had as a kid?
Oh, yeah. And oh, it's cool. I play it on the album.
Oh, very cool.
This is it. Like that.
Nice. Awesome.
So that's really cool, because that followed you around as you made your way through. So you started toy piano, and then you said you graduated to the standard piano. Is that what you said?
Yeah, then I got an upright piano, and then I quit playing the piano at some point, and I played guitar. Or I think first I played accordion, because I heard someone playing a concertina on a boat, like at a festival or something. And I thought that was cool, so I wanted to learn accordion. And after accordion, I tried playing the guitar and took lessons on that for a while. And then I heard the sitar on the George Harrison album, All Things Must Pass.
Ah, okay.
And I thought that was really cool sounding. So I was like, "Mom, I want to play that." And I didn't know what it was. And she knew, because she was an original hippie. And she said, "That's a sitar." And she found the Ali Akbar College of Indian Music in San Rafael, California. it was only about 30 minutes from our house. So wow. I started going to class there and the sitar really stuck.
Wow.
I wanted to ask you a question about the sitar, Gabby. The stuff that we've seen you play with Les Claypool on the sitar is absolutely mind-blowing, both on terms of the adaptations that you do of his songs to the sitar, but also the improvisations that, that you used to do with the fancy band on stage. So I wanted to ask you, how hard is the sitar to master?
Oh, well, I'm not a master in any means, but I try my best. And I think it's just like any instrument or anything you want to do in life. If you apply yourself and put the time in, anyone can learn how to do anything. So I just really was into it. And I put a lot of time, many hours into learning my instrument, and practicing was important to me, you know, before, like when I first started playing and leading up to working with Les Claypool, I was practicing a lot. So if you practice, you can do anything.
I've also noticed the interesting approach that you have to the instrument in a physical sense, because when I think about a person playing the sitar, the majority of people I've seen doing it are always standing, and they have the sitar on their lap. And I think you're the only person I've ever seen playing a sitar standing up.
I used to play, before I played with Les, I was playing in a few different bands in LA, and I played in this Dakha hip hop orchestra and with a band called Weapon of Choice. Mm-hmm. And in both of those bands, I started out like kind of sitting on the edge of the stage. I kind of perched on the edge of the stage with my legs dangling down. I was like, okay, this feels a little bit cool and a little bit less like traditional. Eventually I was like, I don't want to just sit here. I want to like get in on the fun, and like, I want to rock out and I want to be cool. And so I sewed a strap for my sitar, and I just figured out like it was just an experiment, and it totally worked. So I have made like only two ever, because once I make it and it fits right, then I just leave it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You've got to go with it, because it's, I got to imagine that it's pretty tough to get that dialed in.
It's just an awkward shaped instrument, and the balance is weird. Yeah. I ended up having everyone who plays Indian music ends up having back problems, because we're sitting on the floor all the time and we're twisted in a different way. Like, just like someone, if you're right handed, you always write with your right hand, so that arm is going to be stronger. And then I would play. So you play this one way with your one arm up and one arm leaning and twisting with this leg over the other leg, and it's bound to cause problems physically. So I think actually creating the strap was better for my back, but any repetitive motion also creates a problem. So yeah, I have to do a lot of stretching. Yeah, also.
Definitely. It seems like it probably balances better when you're standing up with the appropriate strap.
Yeah, you have to kind of stand to one side. Mm-hmm. Like,
oh, okay. Lean. So that's why it looks like you're always giving people attitude when you're playing, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, dang, I'm not messing with her. She's she's about to
I'll just literally drop my instrument on the ground if I don't.
To kind of bring it back, it sounds like your folks were very supportive if you found an instrument you wanted to try or learn about, and they fostered that. So, but it also sounds like these things stayed with you, piano, accordion, sitar, guitar, and so on. So, you know, you said you're not a master, but I don't know. I always think like, if I can do it, to a degree, I say I can get around on that thing. So
I can get around on it.
Okay. I can get around on it. I can record an album. dividing your time between all those different instruments, what is practice like on a normal day for you? This is not a question I had planned to ask, but that many instruments. So interesting to me.
No, I don't practice everything every day.
Okay.
I just like, I have everything available to me, and I just will go with whatever is feeling right. And even like recently, I enjoy playing an instrument that I can't get around on that easily because less familiar, and I have fewer things that are like go-to chord progressions or go-to patterns. So I like to go to an instrument that is somewhat foreign. So lately I've been actually just playing keyboard once in a while. Mm-hmm. I just don't feel that masterful of that instrument, so I feel freer on it.
Do you find that you, and you mentioned this, so do you find that you are just trying to create sounds that you normally wouldn't make on the other instruments then? So you're, like you said, avoiding those progressions you normally would play. Are you kind of plinking around on the keys looking for something new?
I just try to go almost into like a trance of like not overthinking the patterns or what I'm going to do, and maybe approach it from a visual thing, like, okay, I'm going to do this shape or this combination of notes, like skipping one or skipping two black notes, like do it, just try to approach it from a different place.
Yeah. As far as recording, you know, writing music and that sort of thing, is that kind of a jumping off point for you? Or are you mostly starting on instruments that you can get around on?
I was into, at the beginning of like the quarantine stuff, I was really into playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. And I was learning more chords on the guitar again, because I really only did that pirate song, and then I never recorded anything else on guitar. Mm-hmm. And so I started playing acoustic guitar at the beginning of the quarantine, and I wrote a bunch of new songs on that. And I liked that also because I wasn't that familiar with the instrument, so I had that freedom of not knowing, not having all these rules, and I could make shapes and combinations that, you know, there was nothing in my head saying that's wrong.
That's so reassuring to hear, because what gets drilled into our head, the people that are doing this, I don't think they're being malicious about it, but they come in and they hear the rules. You know, and you hear, you have to know the rules to break the rules. And to a certain extent, I agree. But it's also nice to pick up something like a guitar, or, you know, I might break into a church and check out the pipe organ or something, right? Before they haul me away, I don't know the rules, but it's really cool to just check it out and plink around and find something that sounds good without knowing the rules. So there's a lot of ways to think about it, but it's great to hear you say that there are none. And so it's a freer feeling.
Yeah. So I really like doing that. And then as I make up some songs on the guitar using shapes or chords that I'm just figuring out by ear. Mm-hmm. Later, I might try to learn another song and discover, oh, that's like some form of D chord, or, and then that kind of opens up what I'm learning also. So now I know D, and I know some other form of D. Mm-hmm. And then I see what's related to that. So that leads to deeper understanding.
I hope on your next album, there's an explanation too. Say after a song, you can have an explanation track. And say, you see the D13 chord created tension, you know, and we can understand it better, because it's always helpful.
That'll be the B sides.
So you grew up in the Petaluma area, is that correct? And you're in the Bay Area. So as a teenager, because we're pretty close in age, and I think I was probably 90, I want to say 92 or 93, that somebody handed me a tape that had Primus on it. But I'm curious, around that time, were you aware of the Bay Area scene? Because there were a lot of bands that were just getting huge at that point in that area. Were you aware of what was going on there?
I'm not sure. I was like growing up in high school, I used to go to the Phoenix to mm-hmm. see shows a lot, which was like the underage club that you could, they have like big concerts. And that's where I saw Primus play in high school. Yeah. And so I was into Primus. I was into Green Day.
Yeah.
And I got into punk rock kind of music. Like I liked X, and then like in a different direction a little, I liked Dinosaur Jr., mm-hmm. the stuff I was into. And then I was like really into like the Bee Gees and like disco music for a while. And then I got the sitar, and then I was really into all the 60s vibe and just everything that was going on in the Bay Area in the 60s. and 70s. And so I guess I had like a spread of things. And then I was like always listening to Live 105. They had these call-in, which is like a radio station, and they always had free concerts that you had to win tickets to. And I went to a lot of those, and that like opened me up to hearing all the current bands that they were playing.
Okay.
And that was like, they might be Giants and Frank Black and the Pixies were really big for me.
Wow, that's a laundry list of really great bands.
Yeah. And what was your impression of Primus when you saw them live for the first time, Gabby?
Oh, I was a big fan before I saw them live, and I really wanted to go to this show, and my parents were like, "Well, you're not going to that by yourself." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not going with you guys." So then they were like, "Okay, find someone to be like your chaperone." So then my friend's older brother was the only one I could find who was interested in going. And so I was like, fine. Okay. So my parents bought him a ticket, and then we got there and he ditched me and hung out with his friends, but I still had a really good time because I didn't want to go with him anyway. Yeah. So,
oh, everybody wins.
Good. We all got what we wanted. I don't know if this actually happened, but in my memory, I was in the mosh pit and then I like stage dive and got like carried around the mosh pit.
Oh, wow.
That's my memory of it.
What about what year was this?
I think I was a freshman in high school.
I'm going to do really bad math because I know we're close in age. So this probably, like, I'm going to guess 92, 93?
93 or 94.
Oh, okay. Wow. So they're like getting big at that point and playing essentially a hometown show. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I was a really big fan. Like I knew all the songs, so I was really hyped. Wow. And then to later, and I had the poster on my wall and stuff. So like I was really stoked when I just got to meet Les.
Yeah.
Some people don't look back on these kind of things, Gabby. But I mean, if you think about it, it's really mind blowing that you were watching Primus perform live. You were in the middle of the mosh pit, and just a decade later, you would be actually working with Les Claypool on his music. Have you ever pondered about how amazing that is?
Yeah, I know. I feel really lucky. It's pretty cool. I think like it was never my goal. Like when I went to see them play, I wasn't like, oh, I want to be a musician. I want to be on that stage. Like I was more, I don't think I had, maybe that year is when I got my sitar and started playing sitar, but I was kind of like, I sucked at guitar and I didn't really think that would be like my thing, like playing music. And because also I hadn't found my instrument yet. So I was like, it's like struggling at every instrument. I liked music, but it wasn't a dream for me at all yet when I saw him. But looking back on it, then I'm like, wow, I really like, I don't know, maybe that's why I named my album Be Careful What You Wish For.
I'm sure there, and we'll get into it, I'm sure there was some kind of weird, not intimidation, but just being in that moment going, how did I get here? When you get into those situations, it can be strange. If that wasn't the point in time for you to pursue music as you did, when do you think that happened for you?
Oh, like when I was like, oh, now I know what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
I think when I started studying at the Ali Akbar College, studying sitar, I thought I want to be like the best sitar player and I want to do concerts. But like I wanted to do classical Indian music concerts. And then I was just like, I am going to rule this place. Like, I'm going to rock this and like just practice really hard. And it was this whole like community of people who are like really into practicing and really into like following what their teacher says. And then like, then hang out between classes and talk about it. And like, it was cool to be in a group where everyone was so focused on that. And, so I did like class. I was like going for classical music, and like all the way until I got to college. And then when I was at CalArts, I met a bunch of people who were playing in bands. And I started going to shows more of people that I knew and seeing like, oh, that's something I can do. Like I go to class with that person and now they're on the stage and they're like at this party thing and this is fun. So then I was like trying to be in some different bands playing my instrument. And I think that's when I really started feeling like it was a possibility. But I still hadn't even really written like my own songs yet. And I hadn't found my voice in that way. I was supporting other artists. Well, I met Les at a session and then he asked me if I wrote any songs and I hadn't really written any songs yet. Mm-hmm. I had like a few weird ideas and I just was like, yeah. And and then I was like, oh yeah, you want to hear it? And I just a cappella sang something. I don't know what I did, but he was impressed, I guess. And then he was like, well, you should come back and we'll record a song. And then that led to, that was cool. And then let's record an album and I'll put it out on my label.
Wow, that's amazing, Gabby. But what is the context of this session? How did you and Les end up in the same studio? What were you working on in that session?
It was on Big Eyeball in the Sky, song with Norwood's on it and Lonnie Marshall.
Hey everybody, quick editor's note. Gabby said Eyeball in the Sky. She meant Purple Onion. And it's all good. This is the track she's talking about, Dee's Diner. Back to the interview.
And so I just tagged along because I knew them. I think I had a car, so I could drive us to the session.
Wow.
And so we went, I just brought my sitar because that was like the funk way. The way of funky people is you just bring your axe mm-hmm. and you just get up on stage and rock no matter, like you weren't invited, but like, you're like, hey,
yeah.
Like, so I had been like hanging out with all these like Norwood and Lonnie and P-Funk people and playing at all these jams. Cool. So I was like ready to jam. Yeah. Like I could just like slide in and do my thing. And so they're like, just bring it, just bring your sitar, like, just come. And so I just came in there and set up and it worked out. So,
wow.
Did you feel nervous at all, Gabby?
No, I didn't feel nervous because at that point I had met a lot of famous people, yeah. like from living in LA. And I'd played with P-Funk and I played yeah. with, I think, like, I had played with Chaka Khan. Chaka Khan came to this show and played my sitar.
Whoa.
And I have somewhere like a Polaroid picture of her playing my sitar.
Wow.
But so I wasn't too, like, I was like hyped because I was like, oh shit, like I'm at Les Claypool's house. This is fresh. But once I was there, I was like, I got to just hold it together.
Yeah. I guess if Norwood and Lonnie are saying, yeah, it'll be cool. I mean, that's pretty good encouragement too. So, and this is just a product of just showing up and bringing your instrument.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So I think it's really important, like I said before, is like to just practice and yeah. put the time in when you don't have anything going on for everyone right now
right.
in quarantine or whatever. You're at home because of coronavirus. Nothing's going on. Maybe there's nothing on the horizon. Like, this is the perfect time to put in those hours of practice or whatever you want to get good at, cooking. Like, I learned how to bake all different kinds of stuff that I was never a baker. My sister's a baker. I was like, can I get some more yeast? Like, I made pizza dough. I was like, whoa, I didn't even know I could do that. But yeah, it's just like you got to put the time into practice
yeah.
when you don't have anything coming up because you don't know when that thing's going to come up.
And if somebody asks you if you have songs in your pocket, you say yes. Is that the other thing?
Oh yeah, confidence. Always say yes.
I'm writing this down.
Just say yes. I do. You got a whole album of songs? Yes, I do. But a lot of people work better under pressure.
Right. You know? Are you one of those people?
No, I don't need to have a deadline to get stuff done, but that is how it worked out for me in the case of my first album. But I just see a lot of people who, like, you get the assignment or they're like, okay, here's your thing. And then it's due in 2 weeks. And then it's like been 2 weeks minus one day. And they're like, still haven't done it. I was like, dude, if you took care of it the first day you got it, you weren't doing anything. You could be just chilling now.
Yeah.
Instead of sweating.
I think for some people, the worst thing they can hear is it's due in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Because
that gives them 13 days to do whatever. And sometimes I'm one of those people, and it's rough.
That's how my boyfriend is like that too. He needs a deadline, but I don't need it, because then I feel too much pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that first album and those sessions. So you're on the radar, and Les Claypool says, yeah, come on up, we'll record an album, which awesome. You told him you had some songs at that point when you first met him. But going into the studio to record, did you have these songs squared away?
Well, first he said, just come with one song or two songs or something. So I went and I wrote two songs. Mm-hmm. And then I came back and we did that. And then he was like, that was cool. Got any more? Like, yeah. And then... yeah, I always like to come prepared, but I don't need a long time to work on something.
Okay, so I think you wrote all those on your own. You're credited, right? That's all you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you had those in hand or brought them in, and then you start the recording process. So this is, over the years we've heard and learned that when Les is working with somebody, he really likes to push them. Like creatively, not like physically, I hope, but yeah. just really push them creatively. Like, what if you tried this? Or, here's what I'm hearing. Let's go here. What kind of conversations were there around your tracks as you guys were recording them and tracking them?
Well, I think it was mostly my character and my voice.
Yeah.
That he was encouraging me to just go full on with it. And not hold back. Mm-hmm. And he'd be like, just like full Betty Boop, like just go all the way, go hard, like whatever. So
yeah,
that was mostly the direction that he gave. But other than that, I just wrote the songs basically as they appear on the album. And I recorded them like playing the instrument and then singing. And adding a few layers, but it was basically the same as when I just came in and played it. Cause also it was before like iPhones and stuff. So I didn't really, I think maybe I had a tape recorder or something. I didn't own a computer until years later.
Well, good for you, by the way, cause they're a pain.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you bring in these songs. Are you playing on a click track then as you're recording your tracks, or just kind of free?
I don't remember.
Okay. No, it's been a while now.
Yeah.
Understandable. But that's so cool so you record your tracks, your instruments and your vocals, and you're going the full Betty Boop, as you put it. Was that idea, now you got some encouragement to go in that direction, but was that something you were already cultivating on your own?
I don't think I had Betty Boop in mind, but right. I was doing kind of like a cute, like a hyper cute thing. And so he just got wind of that and encouraged me to go with it.
Oh, okay. I wondered if it was more intentional. It does sound like you were kind of going in that direction, given the, I guess, the content, like lyrical content, because it's on the surface, it sounds like a kid's album, right? To some people, like to me, I was like, is this like it? But then I started listening and went, well, there's more sinister stuff going on here, which makes it more interesting to me.
Yeah.
So was that kind of intentional to kind of draw people in and then pull that rug out from under them?
I didn't do it intentionally, but I think it's just like my natural musical expression. Mm-hmm. Just those kind of cautionary tales, yeah, based on the structure or like something about nursery rhymes. I just grew up singing all the nursery rhymes, and like, I mean, if you listen to the lyrics of a lot of nursery rhymes, they're pretty dark.
Yes.
They're so like, as a mom now, like when I started singing things that I knew, I was like, should I be saying this like in front of my kid? Like, that's kind of dark. So yeah.
you're, you know, when the bell breaks, sorry, kid, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All of that stuff, they're all cautionary tales and based on history or that kind of thing. So I guess that's like the foundation of my inspiration, are like traditional nursery rhymes and children's songs. And so I just kind of created my own and tried to use like everything that I had learned up until that point. So I was like, I'm going to use like all my instruments. Like this one, I play the toy piano. That one, I play accordion. This one, I play the sitar, even the guitar. The guitar, the pirate song was the hardest to record because I sucked at the guitar so bad. But yeah, yeah. I had to do so many takes. I was like, oh, this is so embarrassing. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm glad you had the leeway there, though. That's good. That helps things out, I imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Because you talked about trying to find your voice and just delving into what you knew. For a lot of people, I don't know if they understand that you can just go with what you know, as far as performance goes. And I, you know, I kind of wanted to be a singer and for a while. And I was like, you know, I'm going to be like Les Claypool. But then I was like, well, that doesn't really fit me. And then I heard some other, then I saw The Music Man with Robert Preston. And I went, now that, I want to do that. And then I heard some other guys, and my wife many years ago told me, you know, you kind of sound like Howard Keel. I had no idea who the hell that was, but he sings like this. And I was like, oh man, I could do that. You know, that's my range, at least. So it gave me some grounding, you know, and I did a few vocal lessons here and there. Yeah. My record will be out in about 2068 if you are still around.
Oh, no.
So
that's too long.
Oh, OK. Well, I'm working on it. We're getting there.
Just put out a single.
Oh, I can do that. Absolutely.
And we don't have to wait so long.
Will do. Oh, my gosh. You're going to be number one on the thank you list.
Okay.
Well, I said 2068 because I got to give myself a lot of time, right? But it sounds like you had to deal with some deadlines. Do you remember your time frame for recording that first record?
Well, it wasn't rushed at all because it was his own label.
Yeah.
So there wasn't anyone saying this is the deadline, but it was just, he's like, okay, you got more songs? Yeah. And then, okay, you want to come over next week? I was like, okay, sure. Like, he was just on, it was like downtime. So he's like, come on over. Cause, I was living back with my parents in Petaluma. It was pretty close to where he lives. So it was just like being neighbors. He'll be like, you want to come over tomorrow? I'll be like, all right, cool. So we just, recorded it pretty casually. It wasn't meant that many sessions in my memory.
Well, that's cool, because I do remember him saying, like, around that time he was doing a lot of work. So it seemed like, I think he said the Big Eyeball in the Sky record was 2 weeks, which is what? Yikes. They recorded that in 2 weeks. Now that's a grind. Like, that's getting it done. So it sounds like you had more time than that, which is good.
Yeah, it wasn't rushed, but it was just like, maybe there was a deadline, but I wasn't really aware of it. I don't know.
Okay.
We just like go in and like do a few songs and then like, all right, see you tomorrow.
Well, that sounds nice and relaxed and collegial too. So that's a great way to go about it, I think.
Yeah.
Finding what works for you. I know that Frankie has a lot of those questions about specifics, so I'm going to turn it over to him and try to pretend I know what he's talking about too.
All right. Okay, Gabby, so if you don't mind, I'd like to go over your work with Les Claypool chronologically, because I have some specific questions about each different era that you participated in.
Now I'm nervous.
All right, okay. So starting off with Bucket of Bernie Brains. I mean, the official lineup for that tour includes Buckethead, Brain, Mantilla, and Bernie Worrell. But you were also an integral part of this band, because you played at every single show from that tour. sitting in on Elephant Ghost, Hip Shot from the Slap, and The Big Eyeball in the Sky. So my first question about this tour is what it was like for you to be on the road with these legendary performers like Bernie Worrell, Les Claypool, and of course, Buckethead.
It was really fun. It was my first big tour that I've ever been on. I had only done like, we're going to drive to LA. We're going to go. So that's all I had done was just like drive and do one or two shows and then come back home. And so this one was like really big and they let me ride on the tour bus too. Cause it was just me. Like I got to a lot of firsts and I got to like hang out and become friends with everyone in the band, like just hanging out. I really got to be friends with Les, even though we had like hung out, you know, and recorded the album. That was like really cool. No Les and like Buckethead and Brain, so nice. And Bernie and I really connected and had a nice friendship as the oldest and the youngest on the bus.
I was about to ask you about Bernie because Les has said that not only was he an amazing musician, but he was also a really nice person to be around.
I don't know. We just connected in a really sweet way. And he was just really, really silly person and always a day off in San Francisco, which is like a day off at home. My parents always, and they came, Mom and Bernie really hit it off. Like everyone got along really well. And like my mom came and brought like beef stew or something to the hotel. I went home and then Bernie was like, it was Halloween too. P-Funk had a show. So like he invited my mom and my sister. I don't know why my dad didn't go because my dad used to come to everything also, but my mom and my sister and I all went to see P-Funk and then my mom brought him beef stew and he ate that in the hotel room. And then we went to the show and like he had us all come up on stage with him and stand like behind the keyboard.
Yeah.
And it was just like, really cool, like be there with my mom. Yeah. It was just really cool. And then later, he had me sing and write the lyrics for a song that he did with Prince Paul that was really cool for me too.
When you were not performing with the band on stage on those specific songs, you know, they were playing the rest of the tracks or they were jamming. What did you used to do, Gabby? Did you hang by the edge of the stage watching them play or were you doing something else? How did you spend your time while you were not playing on stage?
I think most shows I have friends like all over the country. So people, I'd have like a friend visiting usually. And so I'd usually like either be playing or go backstage and like have drinks with my friends and then go out and enjoy the show a little. And yeah, so I'd always be visiting and they're usually like my parents' friends because my mom's from the East Coast and they both lived in Philadelphia and Boston at one point. So whenever I go to the East Coast, like almost anywhere, there's like a friend of my parents. So they would always come to the show and pick me up. So I'd usually be like hosting my parents' friends.
That is not a common thing on tour, I have to imagine.
Yeah.
It sounds like it might also, though, alleviate the monotony. I'm guessing after a couple of weeks, you kind of figured out it's get on the bus, go to a city, play, do something, get on the bus, go to another city.
Yeah. And I used to go shopping or go to like the museum on my day off. So I'd go to like in Minneapolis. Isn't that where they have that giant spoon with the cherry on it?
I am not certain.
I don't know. I think that's where the spoon with the cherry is. So I went, you know, like I'd usually either like if there's a day off, I'll go to see the museum or I'd meet up with my parents' friends or if I have friends there. And then, but most days it was like me and Les going out to lunch.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Gabby, you mentioned, you know, being on the tour bus every day with this band, which is absolutely incredible. And I will understand if you can't go into specifics, because we all know that Buckethead is like a mythical figure. But what were your conversations with Buckethead like? What was it like interacting with him on a personal level?
Buckethead is like a very shy person. Like, I wasn't a big fan beforehand. I wasn't not a fan. I just didn't know about him that much before I met him. And when I did meet him, and then it was like, okay, here's the rules. Like, there were a bunch of rules.
Wow, really?
Like, like bringing people to the backstage or on the bus and taking any pictures and telling anyone like what he looks like or anything. But he's really tall and he has that, that's his real hair. So, I mean, I don't see how you wouldn't know it was him. Plus, he basically wears the same clothes the whole tour.
He's
like, that was pretty gross. Just, I'm the, like, as being the only girl on the bus, I heard later that everyone was holding their farts in, but.
Oh, they're so polite.
Also, he had, like, I had, like, a big suitcase because I had, like, all different costumes that I used to wear. And, like, I have, like, various shoes I want to wear, like, over the course of a month. And anyways, he had, like, a tiny little suitcase, and I think he just wore the same outfit the whole time.
Wow.
But he was very, very kind and nice person. And like, I really liked him, but he's a real eccentric, like, kind person. Yeah.
So it sounds like from the time that you spent with them, you really got to know Les Claypool and you connected with Bernie a lot. But Buckethead would be on the quieter side of things, right?
Oh yeah, because I kind of had a crush on him, but he was very shy.
Yeah,
and like if you try to like flirt with him, he'll be like, "Oh shit!" Like he'd be like out of there.
Oh wow!
In a second, he was not ready for anything like that. But he was really cool. He showed me how to do nunchucks.
Oh, awesome!
Wow, that's awesome.
I only got one hand going. But he taught me how to, he was like showing me how to do the nunchucks backstage. So I was like learning how to do that from him. And I have this little toy he got me. It's at my parents' house still somewhere. But I remember he came on the bus one day. He's all here. Like, awesome. Thanks. He was really, really nice, but weird guy. And Brain is totally nice and awesome. And they're all like quirky people. That's why we all get along.
Now, in terms of the songs, Gabby, speaking about The Big Eyeball in the Sky and Hip Shot from the Slab, did Les ask you to contribute to these tracks, whatever came to your mind as you heard them, or did he have a clear idea what he wanted you to do on them?
I think I just came up and jammed on those songs. Of course, play in the same key that they're playing in. Yeah, it was just like, these are the songs you are welcome on. Like, come up, maybe, and then go.
Do you have any particular memories, Gabby, of the Sacramento show on November 3rd, 2004?
What?
I told you he was going to get specific.
So I'm bringing this show up in particular because you had Don Silva from Sly and the Family Stone as a surprise guest. Or Red Hot Mama, and yeah, I wondered if that left a particular impression on you.
Oh yeah. It's funny because like I didn't really. I was like, there's no way I'm gonna remember this show, but that I do remember that show because Don, Bernie, and I really got along. So Bernie would usually come hang out in my dressing room because it was like all of them in the other one, and it was just me and mine. He'd be like, "Hey, what's up?" Like. And then, and so he and Don were old friends. So Don was hanging out in my dressing room too. And we really hit it off. And like, we're still friends from meeting that one time. She was just, she's a really cool person. I like her a lot.
Wow, that's so nice. The last question about Bucket of Bernie Brains is that, you know, the three songs that you play on are quite intricate and quite difficult songs in terms of structure. And, you know, they are by no means conventional tracks, particularly Elephant Ghost. I mean, we're talking about a song that got extended up to even 20 minutes at some shows of that tour. So did any of these tracks seem particularly difficult for you to perform on stage, or, you know, did you just feel them in the moment and they were fun to play?
Actually, I don't think I ever heard a recording of them before I played them. Like, I just, he was like, okay, you're going to come up on this one, that one, and the other one. And I was like, okay, what key is that in? He's like, oh, you can figure it out. And then I just like got in my zone and played. But that's what my training, I think Indian classical music, it's a oral tradition and you're taught to learn by ear and to repeat anything that you hear. Like your teacher will play and you have to just play, repeat it immediately. So you, it trains your ear and it trains your body physically to react in a mimicking way. And then your confidence is built when you're learning how to jam in like funk music or jam band stuff. When you go out there and you just improvise, they're both improvised traditions. And so I think all my work that I put in for Indian music and then like the fun times of jamming came together to make me strong enough to face this challenge of just get up there in front of like the packed house and play this song. But I felt so welcomed by the whole band that I didn't feel worried. I felt really supported. And like everyone, I felt like everyone really wanted me to succeed and they wanted me to grow and be successful. So it was a good feeling. And I never felt like, oh shit, like I'm about to go down. Like people, like I felt like everyone was rooting for me.
So you mentioned facing a crowd, Gabby. So that brings me to my next question, which is a transition between Bucket of Bernie Brains and your next big tour with Les. And it's a one-off performance at the Jammies in Madison Square Garden. I mean, what was it like for you performing with Les in such a massive venue?
That was really, really fun. And it was like my first like awards show kind of thing that I've ever been to. The Madison Square Gardens thing was really big for me because I had only been there one time to see Prince perform. And wow. It was like for my 16th birthday or my 18th birthday. I think it was my 18th birthday. Wow. I went with my one of my best friends, Kathleen, who lived in New York, and she was like in the fan club and she was like, I bought us all tickets. We're going to see Prince. And I got the fan club seat and it's going down. I got two tickets for both nights and you're going with me the first night and my friend Haley's going with me the second night. And like, I have a picture. Wait, I got to show you my picture.
Oh, yes, please. For those of you listening at home. Sorry.
You can't see it on the podcast, but this was the night we went to see Prince at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
Rockin'. Excellent.
Like I keep this like right on my wall because it was a big, it was an important night. But so that was the only time I ever been to Madison Square Garden. So I was like, oh my God, I'm playing there. Like this is crazy. And that led to like a lot of big things for me. So not only was it really fun to play on the stage and like the cameras were going around, you know, like
right, and, flying all over. Were they, yeah, they had cameras all over the place, right? Like not drones.
Yeah, it was like, you know, like it was like you're on TV. Like I'd been on TV once before, but not like that. Yeah. And then they had like this whole tequila room downstairs. and we had done like a lot of shots of Patron. It was just like a really crazy night. So, and then it led to a really cool picture that ended up being like a double page thing in Relics magazine, like a full spread thing of me. And I was like, oh my God, everyone was freaking out. Like, this is it. This is crazy.
That night got you some, I guess, notoriety then and helped help build things out for you. Is that what you were hinting at?
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, I felt like everything was just building and building, and then the Relics thing came out, and then I think that was the same time I played at Joe's Pub. I did my own show at Joe's Pub in New York, and then we went and did Jazz Fest in New Orleans, and that was like so fun. I'd never been to New Orleans, and it was just the most fun maybe I've ever had in my life. Yeah. And my parents and my sister all came out because they were like, you're playing at Jazz Fest, we're coming. And like my sister stayed out all night long. She never does that. Like I told you, she's the baker.
Oh, right. Yeah.
She's like a baker and a reader. She's like, I can't believe, she's like, the sun's coming up. Like, just so you know, this is never happening again. And like they all stayed up all night for me to play like a 4 a.m. tweener set at Tipitina's.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
That's awesome.
So it was a really, that whole little tour, that little set of shows was really fun and important. And like my whole family remembers it very fondly. Yeah.
Well, that's the connection. That's such a cool connection that your whole family got to enjoy that as you're, I guess, ascending, you know. But a side question, you get your schedule. You're on at 4 a.m. What's your first thought?
Well, I had already been there a few days. People just told me that it was cool.
Okay.
Like, I didn't know. I was like, I don't know if I want to stay up that late. Like, yeah. I was that person where I didn't know anything. There were a bunch of times where people are like, no, Gabby, you should hang out here because these are important people from the label. I'd be trying to leave with my friends and they were like, no, Gabby, you have to stay. I'm like, I don't know. I'm tired. I don't want to play at 4 a.m. They're like, this is legendary. You have to. I was like, really? Oh, fine.
So, but not I hope it wasn't your crankiest set you ever played. It sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Oh no, I totally had fun.
Yeah, good.
And I felt really special and excited to like be like doing this thing like I never thought I'd be doing. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool to look back at those times. And I'm always like, I hope I get to do it again, but now it really seems like I never will. Because of Corona.
Yes, it's a good thing you got it in when you did.
Yeah. I remember. Well, now you guys recorded me saying it, so I have to write it down.
So at this point, Gabby, you've accumulated all these incredible memories, and you've got to meet a lot of musicians. You went on tour with Les, and then you played Madison Square Garden. And you know, now we're arriving at the next album, which is Wales and Woe. And Les was very clear on this album that he did not want guitar on the record. He wanted unique instruments for it. What was it like for you working on this album, studio-wise?
I don't have that much reference point, like, because I hadn't performed with or recorded that much with other artists. It was just like, you know, I know from touring with Les and from working with him on my album, it's like, he's the boss. So you got to like take his and a mentor. And so it's important to, you know, and it's someone, you know, a mentor you look up to and a friend that you want to please them and you want to you know, still grow as an artist. And you also know that it's a big opportunity to be heard, to be recorded on his album. So you feel some pressure to do your best, but I think I always put that pressure on myself to do my best every time I play. So, but he really pushed me to like be extra weird. And and then like having to try to recreate that live was really challenging at first. But then I learned how to do like the Filipino Ray song. Yeah. Really hard to play
again. Oh yeah, I was going to ask you about that particular song. You have worked with Liz, but Josh and I, from a fan perspective, there are particular songs that we are blown away by the fact that Liz Claypool himself admits they are hard to perform live. And he's mentioned that Filipino Ray is a particularly challenging song to perform. What I didn't imagine is that it was also difficult on your part to approach that song live. Do you think that's the reason it was performed only a handful of times?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that it was difficult for Les to play in any way. But it was always like, I see it on there. I was like, oh shit, I better go listen one more time before I do that. Like, I didn't know we were going to do that tonight. Like,
yeah.
So, but it was, yeah, it was, I had recorded something challenging. So to recreate it, plus, like, you know that people have listened to it and they want to hear what you did on the recording.
Yeah.
And you want to give that to people. So, like, I wouldn't know how to play it right now.
Right.
What about the theremin for the title track?
Oh, yeah. Theremin is so fun to play. But I blew out the power thing in Spain and... I still haven't gotten a replacement just out of being lazy, I think, but I should really get that replaced. But I got the theremin, in North Carolina at the Orange Peel because they make them there, like near there. And they came to the sound check and they're like, here, you should try this. And I did. And it was really cool. So they gave me one. And then, and I just kept playing it, but it's really like a weird thing because it's like all the intervals are in the air. Mm-hmm. And in order to play precise notes, you have to be really like a robot and not move and no one can come into your circle, like your electromagnetic field. Like if anyone comes in there, it's going to affect it. And then you're standing there super rigid trying to like, they have these methods, like you hold a fist and then you open one finger, two fingers, three fingers and back so that you have, it's like hitting frets in the air.
Oh, okay.
The crazy playing from Angelo from Fishbone, because he has his own crazy way of playing, which is what everyone likes.
And how do you feel, Gabby, about Vernon the Company Man having sitar up front and center?
Oh, I like all of that. Yeah. I like to be front and center for sure. All those songs are cool. Now you make me want to go back and listen to the album. Yeah, I felt like it was an honor to have that opportunity to play like that.
So you're credited on Vernon, the title track, Filipino Ray, and the last song from the album, which is a really bizarre track, Off White Guilt, is an instrumental. And doesn't have a particular structure to it. And of course, it was never performed live. Do you remember what was the approach for that track at Rancho Relaxo?
Oh my God, no, I don't remember. I'm sorry. I don't remember.
That's okay.
It's okay.
I'm guessing that was just one of those. That's my guess is that's one of those where it was just, this is going to be the closing track. It's going to be chaotic. Let's do it.
Let's go with that.
In terms of the tour, Gabby, based on what you told us about Filipino Ray and the way you had to really hold a specific posture to play the theremin, is it right to say that this tour was a lot more challenging than the Bernie Brains one?
I feel like I was more comfortable because I had done more performances. Like the Bucket of Bernie Brains one was pretty stressful for me because it was my first tour and everything was new and I didn't know like any of what's normal or what's not normal. And yeah, it was just a lot of firsts. And by the time of Wales and Woe happened, then I had toured a lot. And so I felt much more at ease and I don't know, that kind of thing. Like it was no longer this kind of fear of like, I don't know, am I doing it right? Am I gonna, you know, I felt more secure. I just remember they made me wear a t-shirt that I didn't really like.
But, oh, the fancy t-shirt?
Yeah. He was like, you got to wear the shirt. I was like, ugh. So I had my friend Kirsty. She's really amazing fashion designer and now illustrator. And she like spiced it up for me and she made it into this cool dress. So I was like, ah, take that. So,
oh, you got around the edict with that. That's great. Good idea.
Yeah.
And Frankie, you might remember this. There was, and I'm not going to throw a date at you because I don't remember, but there was some fancy band show that was live streamed.
Yeah, sure.
One summer. And I just remember people were like, there was some place where we were commenting on it and it was just like, you guys were just killing it. Like it was such a cool show. And I hadn't seen any fancy band shows live at that point, you know, figured out I should see what I'm missing. And I was kicking myself going, man, I should have caught these guys because you guys, it was really, really tight and you guys were jamming it out. Like your sitar playing in particular, I just remember thinking she really kicks ass at that thing. And it looks so difficult. So I wanted to throw that out there because it was really cool to see because you can hear it. But when you have that visual element and seeing somebody actually performing, it can take it to a new level. That was something for me. And I still like have that image in my head these days.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank
you. Yeah. I mean, something similar for me, Gabby. You know, when I first got into Primus and Les Claypool, I actually got the fancy DVD before I even had the Wilson Woe CD. So my first approach to those songs was that DVD. And I remember, you know, first I was completely amazed by the fact that you were playing a sitar because I had never seen that instrument incorporated into that kind of music. And then when I heard the album, you know, I mean, I love the album. I know it inside out. But if we compare both things, I think the songs really, you know, you guys took the songs to another level during the live performances.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that configuration, that group of musicians was really cool. And we enjoyed playing together a lot. And we all like hung out more than some other groups. Nice. It was cool. It was like one person was like, people are like really into fitness and like eating good food. It wasn't like the drunken, I don't know, like a cliche tour. It was, everyone was like practicing and working out.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that brings us, Gabby, to your last work with Les Claypool is 2017 in the San Francisco Civic Center with Bastard Jazz. And you were the surprise guest for Wamola and This Diner. What was that like?
I remember that. That was really fun because, one, it's like my hometown. And then reunion with friends and at this like comedy thing. It's just like a very random event. Of like everything is South Park and comedy and then we played and it was just like good time reunion vibes. Yeah. And it was freezing cold. I don't know. I feel like Les, Skerrick, it's all family and like it's just always gonna be like that good feeling when you hang out with them. So it's cool.
That's beautiful. I love that. That's great. And that's what's cool about, I think, that experience is you are, you know, you get on stage and maybe it's like an old pair of shoes. I don't know, or a comfortable old pair of shoes, at least you, because you already have had those experiences. And I mean, is that what it feels like when you haven't been on stage with somebody in many years and then here you are?
Yeah. Like, it's just like, I remember so many times, like you just be playing and then you look over and Les looks over at you and gives you the nod, like, go for it. And you're like, okay. You have to get like a second, like he tells you to go for it as you're supposed to go for it.
Oh gosh. No advance.
It's not like 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
It's like rip right now.
Oh man.
So it's fun. It's like nerve wracking and fun. And
excellent.
Then you just like go off and until you get the nod.
Oh, and then you can stop.
And then stop.
Yeah.
Go.
Did you ever did you ever find yourself like looking at him going, please nod at me. Please nod for me to stop, you know, or did you feel like you could carry it?
No, yeah. So I think there were a few times where he was just like, keep going. I'd be like, what? How long am I supposed to go? Like, is it my show now? I feel like at Bonnaroo or something, he had me play extra long.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, all right.
I guess that's part of the inspired madness of it all that people seem to enjoy. So thanks for being game for that and going for it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Gabby, thank you for creating such memorable music with Les Claypool. We absolutely love the work that you have done with him.
Thank you so much. Definitely. I wouldn't be where I am without those experiences. And I'm always grateful to him for giving me that chance at the beginning. And I just had such a fun time doing all of it. So, and I'm still recording new music that I'm going to put a single out soon, but I just put out one song on that Captain Crook label that you found my album on. And those guys are actually near Eugene.
Yeah.
Oregon. Slade, he's super cool. When I met him, he was like a teenager and he's like, met me outside the Wow Hall and he's like, Hey, can you sign this? It was like, have you seen The Life Aquatic?
Oh no,
yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah. And the guy's like, Anche questo. He has like 20 posters and the guy, he's like, and could you sign this? And could you sign and this one too? He's like, look, man, how many you got? He's like, well, I got all these. He's like, look, I signed these. Just forge the rest yourself. But anyways, Slade was like outside the Wow Hall with a bunch of stuff. And then like we became friends and he's so cool. And he puts out like all his friends' music on his own little label and he puts it out on cassette. But he puts out like all his friends' music on cassette and he has his own like cassette burner duplicator at his house and he does it all himself.
Nice.
Yeah. So he's cool. He put out a Life in Quarantine compilation or like two compilations. So I put a new song on there and you can hear it on the Captain Crook. So that's my latest release.
Excellent. And I'm glad you're making music and putting it out there. And your website's great, by the way, everybody. Go to GabbyLala.com. There's all kinds of cool stuff there.
Yeah.
Great videos, great music. I listened to the Snow Angels stuff, which was pretty darn cool. Like, it was really groovy. But I have questions about the ASMR. Before we go. I'm so interested.
That's the best thing I've ever done.
So ASMR doesn't do too much for me, but I think there's an exception. And I think if somebody did one of scissors gliding through wrapping paper, I would just listen to that endlessly. And oh my gosh, Gabby's got scissors right there. So we're a roll of wrapping paper away from like the greatest experience of my life. That sounded like I could listen to that all day. But the other stuff like that I've watched and people do it on YouTube and monetize it, I'm like, oh, okay, this is not for me, but somebody likes it, which is fine. But your video, the candy sandwich, was – it's so funny to me because I was thinking this is like this should have been on a monitor in the background of the airplane movie. Because it's, you guys are so sincere. It's like in that vein, you know, you're being very serious, very sincere, like talking us through it like you're QVC hosts, but it's the most absurd thing. And I just like it totally, that resonated with me. You know, the audio didn't, but the video, I went, oh, I'm picking up what they're putting down. And I loved it.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed making those videos with Sayuri. And we won funniest at the Spliff Film Festival.
Oh, very good.
For that video, and that really meant a lot to us. And that ASMR stuff, I just got into that through my friend Cece, who I went to CalArts with, and she was like, "You got to check this out. This is crazy shit." And then I was like, "We're doing it."
Nice.
So yeah, it's kind of a parody of ASMR, but it is ASMR also.
Oh, definitely. The audio is there without a doubt. Now, is that something you're going to keep pursuing? Because that candy sandwich was like, I think you've got a gold mine there. If you keep it
up. Thank you. I hope that we can do it. My friend Sayuri, who is my co-host, she just had a baby. Huh? I have to wait for her to grow that baby up a little bit. But I think, and she lives in Portland now also.
Oh, very good.
He used to live like a few blocks away from me, and we would record for, we did the first few in her living room, and then we started doing it at the Petaluma Public Access Station.
Oh, nice.
And working with these guys at Eat the Fish Presents, and they are really cool, like production team, and they shoot and record all of our videos for us. We were really like productive, and then she decided, she's like, "I'm going to move to Portland and I'm getting a dog. And then now I'm having a baby." Oh, I was like, "Man, cool it."
That's a lot of life choices in a short amount of time.
I know. I was like, "Look, I have a dog. I have a baby. I live in Oakland. Like, it's not all it's cracked up to be, bruh." It's cool, but so I hope we will do more videos, but it may be a minute.
Well, I'm looking forward to more of those.
Yeah, we'll do like the diaper change ASMR.
I was going to suggest, if she's got a baby, well, baby it up with the ASMR, the diaper change, the powdering. I'm sure the powder makes a great sound as it hits the baby's bottom.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You have to get right up in there.
Maybe you want to do an audio only for that one. I don't know. I'm not a producer, so I don't know.
Yeah. We were considering like doing a podcast of us just talking on the phone, but ASMR, like whispering over the phone podcast.
Oh, man.
Since we don't live. Yeah. I guess now Zoom, your guys are doing it over Zoom.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll have to talk to you about that later.
Sure. Yeah. Toss us any questions anytime.
Okay.
Well, I think you've got a good idea there. I like the idea of the phone conversations, though. You could do some great stuff with that.
Yeah, because we were looking at like apps on the phone, like record your conversation, and we're like, I don't know, is this good quality? Like, we have no idea. Her husband he works for like AutoTune.
Oh wow!
So he does all of our sound.
Yeah.
For our videos, that's why our sound is so crunchy.
It is. It is quite crispy. I would like, my first suggestion would be, if you do it via Zoom, you can, and then you each record your own local file, you know, so you have your nice mic, like this is a hunk of junk, but you have your nice microphone, you know, and you have your setup, and you each record your file yourselves locally. But, you know, so the Zoom conversation has that weird sheen to it, but your local file won't. And then you guys can do what you would do with it. That's my.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That is good advice. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't think I'd be giving tech help to Gabby Lala today, but here we are. Listen, Gabby, thank you so much for talking with us. I appreciate it so much. And once again, everybody, GabbyLala.com. So much content. Some people not being so productive in this age of COVID, but you definitely are. We really appreciate you talking to us about what you've done and what you're doing.
Thank you.
And it'd be great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gabby. It was absolutely amazing having you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking with both of you and going down memory lane. Now I'm feeling like really good.
Excellent.
Yeah. I forgot about all those good things that happened. Now I'm feeling like super hyped. Yeah.
Right on.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.